We are calling this meeting of House State Affairs to order at 8:08 on Thursday, April 14th. And present are Representative Ramos, Representative Grunberg, Representative Lynn, and Representative Gardner, and Chair Seaton. And today we have first on the agenda the confirmation hearing for Air National Guard Brigadier General Colonel Tony A. Hart of Phyllis. And is he online with us? Okay, he is not online with us. He's in flight, I believe, from here to another area. And so we have the department here to we introduce him for us. So if you would identify yourself and for the record, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman Seaton. For the record, my name is John Kramer. I'm the Admin Service Director for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Colonel Hart sends his apologies. He's not able to be here today. He's at the PACAF conference, which is the Pacific Commanders Conference that's taking place over in Hawaii. He was scheduled to board an aircraft to head back towards Alaska about 8 a.m. this morning and obviously is not able to join us. I think all of you got a biography on Colonel Hart. He came to us in January of this year. He's taken over command of the of our wing, the 176th wing at Culis, and seems to be a great addition to our command. So I don't know what else I can tell you about the man except he's a fine individual. He's a master navigator. He has over 4,000 hours of flying time, and the wing really appreciates having him. So with that, I would take any questions that I might attempt to answer.
Thank you, and I wanted to recognize that Representative Elkins has joined us as well. And are you familiar with the Air War College?
Somewhat.
Can you, I noticed that that's his, in 99, graduated from the Air War College. Could you give us just a little bit of information on what that entails?
Mr. Chairman, I'll give you a little because that's all I know about the Air War College. Officers go to the Air War College, of course, for furthering of their training in regards to air command and tactics and those types of things. Colonel Hart went back to that college, graduated, and I can't recall, but I thought he was in the top, the very top of his class, but I can't say anything to that.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Lynn.
The Air War College is an extremely prestigious college in the military. It's for senior officers. I think it's in Virginia or someplace. I'm not sure. Maybe Montgomery, Alabama, but it's an extremely prestigious college. I believe you normally have to be a bird colonel or a full colonel to attend the War College. Very few officers attend that, and it's almost mandatory to go to the Air War College or the War College to advance to general grade as a brigadier general. So any of us who would be selected for the War College, it's the same as it's a military Harvard, one might say.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that explanation. Does anyone on the committee have any questions? We're sorry that Colonel Hart can't be here today. Does anyone have any questions about, we have his biography and a short statement. Is there anyone that has any concerns?
Mr. Chair.
Seeing none, do I have a motion?
So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Would you?
Would you yield?
Well, yes, I'm going to move.
Just for the record, Colonel Hart has visited a number of us in our offices.
Yes.
I don't know if they're members of this committee or Military and Veterans Affairs. I talked to the man for about 15 minutes with General Campbell. He's got a lot of leadership experience. He's a professional Air National Guard officer in that he has served in a number of positions in Air National Guards nationally, and he has been on staff for the senior generals in the Air National Guard and as liaison to various air commands. Mm-hmm. He comes to us, I think, from Illinois, does he not?
Tennessee.
He's originally from Tennessee.
Correct.
He went to school in Tennessee.
Correct.
Served in the Air Force, got out, became a teacher. I think he also majored in divinity, as I recall. Anyway, we had an extensive hearing in front of the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, and he testified by telephone. So I would ask, Mr. Chair, that the record in that committee be incorporated by reference in today's hearing.
That would be fine. And by the way, we do have a printout here of the Air War College. It says the mission is to educate senior officers to lead at the strategic level in the development and employment of air and space forces, including joint interagency combined coalition operations in support of national security. So we have that on the record as well. And Colonel Hart also visited with me, and I was very impressed with his presentation. And so now, is there any other discussion? Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the nomination of Colonel Hart for the position indicated. I'm very impressed with the man. He also visited my office.
Okay. So the State Affairs Committee has reviewed the qualifications of Colonel Tony A. Hart and recommends his review by the joint session of the legislature. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I was going to send because I like him.
And now we will go on to 160. The next or
167.
Oh, it's 167 is next on our agenda. Sorry. And if Representative Stoltz, I guess I misinformed him. So if you're listening, you'll be second up here. We have House Bill 167. And yes, would you?
Do you want me to get in the hot seat? Or?
Yes, sure. Okay. We'll put you out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You want to get up there, Kim?
No, that's fine.
Okay. And this is sponsored by the House Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs. We have two members of that committee here with us, Representative Lynn and Representative Grunberg. And I guess if toss the coin or selected Representative Grunberg to present the bill.
I'm the chairman, so he gets to be in the hot seat.
That's the way it works.
You have three members there.
Three members. excuse me, Representative Elkin.
If we don't pass this bill out, we've got a problem.
You want to try this? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm the sacrificial lamb this morning. I'm Max Grunberg, member of the committee, represents House District 20, which is Mountain View, Russian Jack, East Anchorage. And my pleasure today to speak on behalf of the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee and offer a proposed CS for House Bill 167. And I guess, is it proper for me to move the adoption of the CS?
You're Representative Lynn.
Mr. Chair, I would move the CS for House Bill 167, 24-LS0605/Y.
And that's for and discussion.
For discussion only.
Thank you. We have before us 167 CS version Y.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually a combined bill. We in Military and Veterans Affairs introduced House Bill 166 and 167, and we have combined them with the chair of Military and Veterans Affairs Committee's permission to get them scheduled together to make it a little easier to move through the system. The first half of the bill, Section 1, is former 167. The second half is former 166. I'll speak to them in turn. House Bill 167 will amend AS 18.50.320 to add a new subsection 7, which is modeled on an Arizona statute. The number of the Arizona statute is ARS 39-122.A, and I think you have Seymour Epstein's death certificate in there showing how it works in Arizona. This is my former uncle-in-law who passed away, Kayla's uncle. And in Arizona, and what we intend to do here is to provide without cost, upon request, the Bureau of Vital Statistics shall issue a certified copy of the veteran's death certificate, and this can go to the surviving spouse, next of kin, or other relative of the deceased veteran for the specific purpose of obtaining veterans' benefits, Social Security benefits, and other governmental benefits. And a veteran is defined in statute, and it has the meaning in AS 26.10.080, and it's a fairly straightforward statute.
Representative Gruender?
Yes, sir.
Before you proceed in it further, we have in our packet a fiscal note for 167. We don't have anything in this packet, I see, for 166 fiscal note. Did you have a combined fiscal note, or should we, if you're combining it, just a moment, a little, would you get the fiscal note for 166 and bring it down so that we can
have it? I have it here in my, if we could just stand at ease for a second.
Yeah, we'll stand at ease for a moment.
For the record, my name is Sarah Hook, staff to Representative Gruenberg. Philip Mitchell from the Department of Vital Statistics wasn't able to be here today, but he is available by cell phone if you have any questions concerning the fiscal note. You can give him a call.
Okay. No, I just want to make sure that if we're combining two bills and we only have the fiscal note from one of those bills, we'd have a problem moving it out today. So I want to get the fiscal note for 166 in our record. Okay. Thank you. Proceed, Representative.
Thank you. 166, which is Section 2 of the proposed committee substitute, is modeled on federal law. And this allows the, it's modeled on 38 U.S.C. Section 112, and it allows a next of kin of a deceased veteran to request from the governor or the adjutant general, it allows the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to issue certificates to veterans who were residents of the state, and not just necessarily at the time of death, but at any time. The family would be, and if they're discharged under honorable conditions, a certificate from the governor expressing the state's grateful recognition of the veteran's services, service in the armed forces, the Alaska National Guard, the Alaska Scouts, the Alaska State Defense Force, or the Alaska Naval Militia. And the eligible recipients are defined to mean the surviving spouse, next of kin, or relative of the deceased veteran. In this sense, the eligible recipient is the same in both sections of the bill, and veteran, again, is defined in AS 2610080, and the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs must determine the form and content of the certificate and is allowed to adopt regulations to administer the program. And as the fiscal note states, it's anticipated that the program will cost less than $1,000 annually to conduct, and they don't know the number of deaths, so it can't be determined what the the fiscal note would be. And actually, there may be more when the program is initially set up, and people for a number of years, their families may be requesting this, but hopefully it's well worth it, because it's a small token of the state's appreciation for people who have really gone out of their way to help the country and the state of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Delighted to answer any questions.
I guess I just have a question on the fiscal note on 167.
Okay.
Where it's saying that the Bureau currently has no general funds, and the projected loss of revenue to the Bureau from receipt support services line will have to be replaced with GF to maintain existing services. Are the effective dates such that this will not negatively impact the Bureau if it can't conduct it? I mean, if this passes and this becomes a current year available, and the testimony is that there may be a backlog, and so there may be a higher amount originally, and yet the fiscal note says that they can't, they have nowhere else other than GF to get this. Do we have a, I mean, it's a fiscal problem. I just need to point it out for the record that we may have this consistency here, maybe combining these two bills that we need to look at.
Mr. Chair, it doesn't cost $30,000 a year to print up these death certificates. It's just a Xerox copy, and they affix a seal. It's virtually without cost. The only thing would be, at least theoretically, these people might theoretically be requesting death certificates. So it's not going to cost the state virtually anything. It's just potentially they could have gotten some revenue out of it. So I really don't think that this is
anything. Okay, we just Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm very curious about the provision that the death certificate is to, for the purpose of obtaining veterans' benefits, Social Security benefits, other government benefits. And I noticed that the sample that you provided from Arizona is stamped, not valid for any other purpose. So I'm sort of curious, what other purposes would there be, and why would we want this death certificate to be available specifically marked not for those purposes?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, in talking with Philip Mitchell from the Department of Vital Statistics, he was concerned that people would start almost taking advantage of the program and getting too many death certificates. You'd have, you know, a long lost cousin coming and trying to get a death certificate for a veteran, for scrapbooks or those cases, and then that was where he was concerned that the fiscal note would start to become too high. So we compromised, and because the original Arizona statute was for veterans' benefits and Social Security benefits, we made a compromise, and he feels comfortable that if people are only requesting him for those reasons, that it would be okay to do this program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Groenberg.
Originally, when we had the bill drafted, and I'm not sure it was in the form, I think this was before we ever actually had it introduced by the committee. It was my feeling that they should be able to get as many as they wanted, or at least want to not have this language in. But Mr. Mitchell was very conservative in his approach, and we decided, at least initially, to take the path of least resistance. The way this is written now, it states that they can issue one certified copy of a death certificate. I would have no problem, and would, in fact, with the chair's permission, Representative Lynn, consider it a friendly amendment if you wanted to broaden that. I don't want to cause a problem for Chair Seaton or anybody. I'm trying to make this as easy as possible, but it's the committee's will, whatever the committee wants to do.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lynn.
I do want to keep it narrow as possible. However, I note here, I'm sure you've seen it before, it says for government benefits, What about private insurance? For example, I have certain government insurance, but I also have some private commercial life insurance policies, which I'm sure somebody will need a death certificate for. I think what we're talking about, we don't want to run so much, we get into for genealogical purposes, because this is a thriving industry, and which is one of my passions. So, not going to that extent, but perhaps for, for commercial life insurance policies.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Groomberg.
As I was saying, if you wish to eliminate the phrase "for the purpose of obtaining veterans benefits, social security benefits, and other governmental benefits," I'd consider that a friendly amendment. If you wish also to say "certified copies," plural, that would be okay with me too. It's whatever you wish. I didn't want to just go off the hook and jeopardize the bill myself. I don't think it will, frankly.
Well, and I think Representative Groomberg and Representative Lynn, I think that you have struck some kind of a compromise here because of the problems of an expanded fiscal note and potential, everybody wanting and everybody for all the cousins and everything to mount on the wall, those kind of concerns. And I can understand those. So I would hate to jeopardize the swift passage of the bill by making it too expansive as well. Representative Gardner?
Thank you. To Representative Groomberg, if we were to strike the words "for the purpose of" all the way down to government benefits, so it said the Bureau shall issue a certified copy of the death certificate of a veteran, would that mean that one time the Bureau would issue a single certified copy?
Just to eliminate that question through the chair, if you do that, why don't you, instead of saying a certified copy, say one certified copy?
And then there would be no additional cost, is that correct? But the copy would not be stamped for this purposes only, and consequently, if they needed to show it for life insurance or something, they wouldn't have to go back and get another copy and pay for it?
That is correct, yes.
And if our intent is to honor the service and make things a little bit easier for the survivors, I don't know why we would say, we'll give you a certified copy, but you only can use it for these things. That doesn't make any sense to me. So I propose this amendment. Offered amendment to delete the word "a" and insert "one."
Yeah, which
I'm
page
sorry,
and line?
Page 2, through. Line 23. The Bureau shall issue one certified copy of the death certificate. And then on line 24, after "veteran," put "period," deleting "for the purpose of obtaining veterans benefits, Social Security benefits, and other government benefits." So it would read, the Bureau shall issue one certified copy of the death certificate of a veteran to the surviving spouse, next of kin, or other relative of the deceased veteran. In this paragraph, "veteran" has the meaning given in.
So, Representative Gardner, you're not putting a period there. You're just eliminating the language for
to benefit,
for
yes.
through benefit.
Yes.
Oh. And we'll make that conceptual, if you can, for the drafters.
So the semicolon would remain.
Semicolon would remain in the definition of veteran.
So
would,
the intent is that one certified copy is available for each veteran, and it's not limited as to how it can be used.
Question.
Very good. Representative Lynn, objection for a purpose of discussion.
Yes. I'm wondering, every time you apply for Social Security, you apply for government insurance, other purposes, burial permits, and so on, and commercial insurance, do you not have to have a certified copy for each one of these where you get one?
Through the chair?
Yes.
At least for Seymour, we got one, and then we just made Xerox copies of it.
And that's sufficient for the insurance period and so on.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other objections to the amendment? Seeing no other objections, amendment number one is adopted to page 2, line 21, striking A between "issue" and "certified," and inserting the word "one," and striking the language starting with "4" at the end of line 22 through "benefits" on line 24.
Six.
that amendment is adopted without objection. Representative Ramos.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gruenberg, I have studied this bill thoroughly. I have seven different amendments to offer this morning. I'd like to go through them. Amendment 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. May I begin?
Well, certainly, as long as they strengthen the bill, but they're not illegal.
Representative Gruenberg, I think it's a fabulous bill. I appreciate you offering it. You're a great man.
And do we have any other discussion on the bill? Do we have any testimony on House Bill 167 in the audience or online?
Just maybe
Representative Gruenberg.
I'm not sure if we can actually just put a note on the how you want to do the fiscal note on 166, but I assume that we could send it along and then just a note to the department if they could combine their fiscal notes.
Yeah, we will request a combined fiscal note. However, for the record, it should be noted that we have the two fiscal notes, one on 167 and 166, in our possession, and this CS is a combination of those two bills, and I presume with the indeterminate fiscal note it will probably pick up a finance referral, but I'm not sure. That'll be up to someone else. Is there any other questions?
Yes.
Any other discussion? Representative Gardner. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on 167? Seeing none, we have anyone online? Public testimony is closed. Representative Gardner.
Yes, I have one quick question. If this law passes, how do people become aware of it?
I'm not sure mechanically how the division will do that. But usually they have, I think, a pretty good network of getting the word out to veterans groups and stuff.
Veterans Service Office.
Frankly, don't know. I can find out for you, though.
I'm just sort of curious if there are benefits to survivors. How, you know, they need to know, or it doesn't mean anything.
Sure. Sarah? If I can.
Representative Gruenberg, that's a question that you can get back to the individual member with.
What we'll do is, Sarah, if you would ask, and we'll get something in writing for everybody.
Thank you. Are there any other discussion on the bill? Do I have a motion on the bill?
Yes.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I move House Bill, Committee Substitute for House Bill 167. It's number 24-LS0605/Y as amended with attached fiscal notes.
We have a motion. Is there any objection? See no objection. The bill will move from committee with an individual recommendation and attached fiscal notes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll now take up House Bill 160.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks.
Good morning, Representative Soltz.
Chairman Deacon, may I staff join me at the table?
Yes, sure.
I don't have a jacket, sir, but I do have a tie on.
But you don't have a hat. Good morning. Would you identify yourself on the record and go ahead and introduce your bill?
Bill Stoltz. I represent House District 16 with Chugiak and several communities in the Mat-Su Borough. Introduced House Bill 160 out of general concern about good public policy. I don't think at any level local governments, government in general, should spend money to try to influence elections. And that was my original intent. Addressing concerns of previous committee of the previous chairman and some concerns of local governments. I didn't want to micromanage every local level. For the purposes of narrowing the focus, we just limited it to statewide ballot propositions and questions, which is broadly defines any initiative or statewide ballot measure that's on a general election or a special election or primary ballot.
Representative Stoltz, are you talking about the CRA CS, or are
yes.
you talking about a proposed CS from that we have from you? We have in our packet a version Y, which is a CS for 160 CRA, and then we have a version F.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that there's the proposed CS, which my staff has worked with your office on, and it was it was the intent of the previous committee to narrow it, and I think there was our legal staff had left out some technical aspect, and that was to very explicitly clarify that it only applies to statewide measures.
And is that in the version F that we're talking about, the blank CS?
Yep. Yeah. Just to clarify, what I'm addressing, what's before the committee is the CRNRA committee version, and there's a proposed amendment which would create.
Okay.
And that's some of these things that our staffs have been working together. So.
Sure, and I just want to make sure that the committee has the appropriate version before them. So we have a CS in their version F that we're not considering at this point in time. What we have is a CRA version before us. It may be offered.
It may be offered.
May be offered, but it's not before the committee. What's before the committee is the CRA version Y.
Okay. Well, anyway, just to finish briefly, it's been my contention that public funds don't belong in the public shouldn't be used to influence election measures. And again, I've compromised. We saw this last election. The Alaska Railroad Corporation gave $20,000 to influence a local election in Anchorage. I think that's inappropriate. This bill won't address it following the wisdom of the previous committee, and that's part of the compromising process. But I thought I'd bring that to your attention. Things like that happen. They can't afford to pay the state a dividend, but they can spend money on local elections. So I'll throw that unsolicited piece on the table. It concerned me. I'll just finish up in a few seconds here. It concerned me this in past previous election cycles, there were attempts to use state funds to influence the outcomes of permanent fund elections, using money from permanent fund corporate receipts to influence the outcome election, and the legislature wisely squash that attempt, but there was a clear attempt to do that, and that's it affected. I wanted to keep this. I wanted it much broader, but again, through the compromise and just because of pragmatism, getting it through the process, the focus has been narrowed to just statewide ballot measures, and primarily to try to accommodate the Alaska Municipal League and local governments, but. They've been still raining terror on my bill, so, but I still will, in good faith, work with them.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stoltz, could you just walk us through the bill as it's outlined here? We're again dealing with the CRA version. It says, except as provided in B and C, each of the following may not use money held by an entity to influence the outcome of an election or candidate or the outcome of, and then it lists a number of entities. Oh, okay. So what we have is that those entities, the state, its agencies, corporations, those listed, the school boards, et cetera, are the agencies, are the entities that could not use money? Is that the way the bill is constructed?
Please go ahead. For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Representative Bill Stoltz. That is correct, sir.
Okay. I'm sorry. It's a little bit confusing sometimes the way legal draft bill.
Can we confirm which bill we're actually on? Are you looking at the one marked F?
Why? No, we are. That's why I was trying to clarify. Right now we have the CRA version. The F version has not been offered. That's okay. The Y version.
Y.1.
Just Y.
Y? Oh, through the chair, sorry.
Yes.
I have a lot.
Representative Gardner, the Y.1 is the proposed amendment to clean up the rest of the bill so it makes sure that municipalities and other political subdivisions can still.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, representative staff, or to Representative Bill Stoltz. Again, the amendment, Y.1, is after talking to legal the first time we did the CRA CS, and we did in section one just to change it to a state ballot proposition. But when we went back through it, we realized that there needed to be more changes. So the amendment is making sure that the rest of this piece of legislation is cleaned up so it separates the fact that now that any, you know, the state, its political subdivisions, the list here in Section 1 cannot use money to influence a state ballot proposition or question, but on a local level, municipality, borough level, they can still do what they have been doing in the past. They can still provide that information they have been.
Okay, and just for further clarification, Y.1 is incorporated to the blank the CS version F, is that correct?
It'll incorporate into version Y, the CRA version Y.
Yes, but it will produce version F. I mean, we have before us a version F. Is that the combination of Y.1 with
I don't have
Y?
That one.
No, it's not.
Mr. Chair, I would doubt that because Y.1 has a later date than F.
Okay. F was the first proposed one, and so we had to clean it up further, so we have Y and Y.1 should be what you guys are looking at.
Okay. Wait.
No, F is different, Mr. Chair. Okay.
So, okay, we're dealing with Y with amendments Y.1 instead of a CS. So for now, ignore the other CS we have.
Sorry, confusion.
Do we have any other questions? Yes, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stoltz, you know, when I look at this, it kind of brings to mind that maybe this is a backdoor attempt to get around the Frank Initiative.
A what?
Frank.
A backdoor attempt to get around the Frank Initiative, which now requires the government to notify the people. In the case of a capital move, the total cost, and this would prohibit them from doing that, and I that this would appear to me.
Thank you.
Okay. Knowing the sponsor, I would doubt that was his intent, but Representative Stoltz.
I'd be happy to clarify that. I think I'm more in favor of the Frank Initiative than the people of Juneau are, because they have a selective enforcement of the Frank Initiative. I want it to apply to all expenses on any capital, and that's, I think I've been very clear that I support the Frank Initiative, and the public's right to know. And this is, and this would not prohibit. This would not. The crux of the Frank Initiatives is that the public has a right to vote on the costs of the relocation of the capital. And I don't dispute that. I think that is a right that the public has demanded twice at the ballot box.
Representative Elkins.
In rebuttal, Mr. Chair, but. But the way I read this under this bill, Representative Stoltz, is that the government would not be able to be allowed to give them that cost so that they could make an intelligent decision. Because they couldn't advertise and say what the cost is, or unless I'm misinterpreting this.
Representative Stoltz?
Mr. Chairman, the government could provide the cost. I mean, that would be a public document. And it's been my experience on any time the capital's been a question, there have been entities that have distributed the costs and the impacts. And I think it's going to be available to the public. It's just the delivery mechanism. I think the press will deliver it. I think it would still be allowed to be printed right in the ballot statement. That's very explicit in our language. I just respectfully disagree. This has any bearing on the Frank Initiative, because I've probably been about as clear as anybody in this body that I favor the Frank Initiative. I've stated so. It's one of the first bills I introduced, was reinforcing the Frank Initiative. I think I'm stronger on the Frank Initiative than the people of Juneau are.
Yeah, and of course, we're not talking really about personal support for different things, but we're just looking at Representative Elkins is bringing up a possible conflict between this law and the Frank Initiative. So I want to make sure that the entire committee and other discussions stay focused on those conflicts and not our support or disapproval of a certain thing. Representative Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Stoltz, I'm fascinated by this bill to move away from the Frank Initiative and the capital move. I'm reading the AML's letters, and a lot of these other letters are from Deputy Mayor Zamatsu, City of Kenai, Houston. I think there's another one here from another small community. The AML weighed in. First problem, in Fairbanks, we had an election some years ago to sell our water utility and sell our phone company, which was voted on by the people of Fairbanks, which has led to the significant PERS deficit that the city of Fairbanks now enjoys, which is an $89 million deficit and growing, a PERS liability and growing. And I remember that election, and there was an enormous amount of funds were spent by folks or by the city of Fairbanks advocating the sale of those assets. And I would appreciate if you would help me a little bit. To what extent is a school system, a city or a municipality allowed to spend money? How much money are they allowed to spend to advocate for school bonds or for Prop 4, as the AML talks about in their letter? How much can they spend? How much of an effort can they put in? Is there a limit presently on it? Can they outspend the private sector in representing the community's point of view?
Representative Stoltz.
Chairman Seaton, if they pass a local ordinance, there's not a limit. I'd point out this bill doesn't at the request of previous committees and respecting the policy direction that the committee system provides and the members, the local government elections was exempted. But it's a good question. I still have fundamental disagreements with government spending the people's money to tell the people how they should vote. That's a fundamental philosophical problem for me. But again, through trying to accommodate the AML and local governments and not wanting to try to second guess the propriety of every single little local election, I valued the wisdom of Co-Chairman Thomas and Co-Chairman Olson and the members of the previous committee and the public testimony. The amount of the letters from I will say AML has been a little bit deceptive in there, but you know, it's, I don't have the amount of lobbyists they have. The city of Juneau has been involved. I don't have the resources or the inclination to lobby like they do. So I'm going to eventually talk to all those people, but I haven't had the chance to yet. And being in finance until almost six every night, but you know, you do what you can with how the deck's stacked against you.
And we just have the bill before is what we have for us. So. I do have a question that was brought up on bond issue. Let's say we would go back to bond issue C. It was a statewide bond issue that was for rural schools construction as well as let 70-30 bond debt reimbursement by municipalities. How would this affect that statewide bond proposition, and who could and who could not use any funds to campaign that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, funds could be used to let people know there is an election, the time and place, and that there, as in any other election. However, there you could not use public funds at any level for a ballot proposition. But I just add that it's been my experience when there's been school bonds, the advocacy groups, as is appropriate in our free exchange of ideas, there hasn't been a shortage of consortiums of groups getting together. Matter of fact, I think it was the only advertising in the last bond election was advocates. There was not a single bit of advertising from the opponents. So it's, if anything, there was probably a stacked, you know, public opinion against it, which was fine. That measure prevailed. But, I don't think there's going to be a shortage of resources to sell good ideas, as we've seen.
I guess what I'm trying to follow up on is if there's a statewide bond issue, if there's a statewide initiative that impacts a municipality, this, whether it's a borough or whether it's a city, as I read this bill, this would prevent that city from really communicating to its citizens through any campaign way of their concerns for that they've been elected to represent with their citizens. Is that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've never known local officials to be shy in expressing their opinions, and they can do that. And I think the appropriate measure is to do what everybody else does, form a political action committee, form an advocacy group. I philosophically don't think it's appropriate to use public funds to influence on election. It's,
sure, and I'm not trying to get into.
I think there's a mechanism available, and it's. I think we all use it ourselves.
Again, Representative Stoltz, I'm not trying to get into that. What I'm trying to do is get into the mechanisms of the bill and what the bill does and doesn't provide. I'm not wanting to debate philosophy here, you know, at all. Was there a question over here, Representative Gardner?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little bit concerned. I'm quite concerned about this bill. Suppose that I'm an employee of, say, a museum, and I want to advocate for the museum expansion. I'm the public affairs official from that museum, and I believe absolutely that it's in the best interest of the community. Under this bill, I would be prohibited from actively working towards passage of legislation that would improve the entity for which I'm responsible. Is that correct?
Well,
Representative Stoltz,
Chairman, I've talked to legal about that. I respectfully disagree. I think you would be prohibited from acting in capacity as the museum director during the work hours and spending public funds. But I don't think you check your First Amendment rights at the door, and I think that's been clearly upheld in the process.
But I'm asking about if it's my job to ensure that the museum gets all the funding it needs or gets the expansion, because that's important for the museum, which serves the function in the community. And my job is to make sure that it gets whatever it needs, whatever resources it needs. So I would be prohibited from doing that?
Before we go on, I'd like to ask Representative Gardner, if you read on page 1, line 6, the first three things there that it says.
Which page 1? Okay.
Yeah, page 1, line 6 says that the following may not use money held by the entity. So
wouldn't my salary, if I'm doing it as an employee,
my
salary is using the money. I'm just trying to say I'm a public affairs officer, for example, for this entity, and it's owned by the government. But I'm the public affairs officer, and I believe that it's important for this entity that a particular ballot proposition goes through. So it's part of my job, but I'm a salaried employee. So,
Representative Stoltz, I just wanted to get the clarification on that.
No, I appreciate that.
Do you have any?
You know, I don't believe that individual that Representative Gardner described would be prohibited from acting outside of the scope. I do think it could be construed as a use of resources if that individual is on the state payroll or actively promoting the passage of a statewide bond proposition. I think that there might be a conflict, but I'll get that clarified.
That would be good to get that clarified, because it could be construed as a use of money held by the entity to have a public relations person working on that. But would you get a clarification on that for the committee? Representative Ramirez.
Yes, Representative Stoltz, I didn't like this when I first read it, but as I read all this vigorous opposition from elected officials, it makes me nervous when elected officials get an unfair megaphone compared to the private sector to try and dictate what the private sector should be doing. So I'm not sure how I would vote for this on the floor, but I believe I support this, the bill, and the notion that we should be discussing how public money is spent to affect the outcomes of these things. I have a letter from my mayor in North Pole. Why is there, in your opinion, why is there such vigorous opposition from all these mayors and assembly folks and council people? That's the predominant amount of letters I have here, all in opposition from elected officials in small communities. What point of view are they representing? What am I missing here?
Well, Representative Stoltz, Chairman Seaton, I think part of it is AML has been on the phone for the last week and saying this is going to prevent you from talking about a local school bond. I think there's been a lot of bad faith misrepresentation, with all due respect. Because I've confirmed some of that through conversation.
Well, I know, but Representative Stoltz, I do want to make sure that we're talking about other people's actions.
You bet. And I have confidence in them.
Okay.
Full confidence.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for the sponsor, and then we're going to go take public testimony. Representative Elkins.
I have a comment, but I'll make it later, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, so any other questions for the sponsor at this time? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that a municipal government can hold money from at least four different sources. Money from its own tax base or revenue source, money from the state, money from federal government, and money from other sources. For example, let's say we have the recent ballot proposition in Anchorage concerning the convention center. It would have been possible for the advocacy group there to have set up a mechanism not to advocate on its own, but to have given money to the municipality. This bill would seem to limit the municipality's ability to use money from any source. Not just state money. And I have a question as to whether constitutionally the state can prohibit federal money from, if it's otherwise allowable, for example, from being used for this purpose, if its purpose under federal law permits a use in this manner, like to influence maybe matching funds or something for a federal road project or something. I think that we don't have any constitutional right to limit that. And secondly, I'm wondering...
Before you go on to your second question, Representative Grunberg, Representative Stoltz, I don't think we can answer that today, but would you request from Ledge Legal an opinion on that for us?
I really hadn't finished it, okay. But on the same thing. And secondly, if the municipality... uses money from its own sources to influence an election, I don't know whether we can limit that, particularly if it's or from other donations, for example. So my question really is to take a look at whether we can constitutionally limit the use of federal money, the municipality's own revenues, or money that's donated specifically for that purpose. Because I do think that a governmental entity also does have free speech rights. So my constitutional question, relates both to free speech and to the Supremacy Clause in the case of the federal Constitution, and the inherent powers of a municipality, three constitutional bases for my question.
Okay, so Representative Stoltz, those legal questions, if you are prepared, that's fine to answer those. Otherwise...
No, we will answer them. I do, Mr. Chairman. I just can't imagine a private entity that would funnel their campaign money through a government. Usually they're not the most efficient entities, and you certainly have a lot more rules. I'm baffled by that idea, but we'll look at it.
We'll
look at it, and we'll get into this in committee discussion. But because what we've got now is questions for the sponsor, and then we're going to public testimony. Is there any other specific questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, let's go to the line, and let's start with... Carol Cuomo in Anchorage, are you online?
I am. Thank you very much.
Just a minute.
I will be brief.
Carol, would you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. I'm Carol Cuomo, the superintendent with the Anchorage School District.
Okay. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you very much. I was very pleased to see the change. In the version I've got in front of me is Y, so I haven't seen Y.1, but... when I talked with Ben in Representative Stoltz's office the other day, I was very pleased to hear that there had been a change to allow municipalities and school districts to continue to educate the public. And what I wanted to talk about were two things. One, We take very seriously our responsibility that we cannot use our public funds to advocate yes or no on any ballot proposition regarding our school bonds. We also feel very strongly that if we have it in our budget, and our costs have been roughly between $25,000 and $35,000 total, if we've had a big bond proposition to educate the community as to the facts. And we have all of our information reviewed by bond counsel and our attorneys to make sure that our information brochures are factual and not using advocacy language. And when we've given bond presentations in the community, we are factual only. The school board, the elected officials, have been able to advocate, but that is not, I cannot do that. As superintendent and my staff cannot advocate, we have to give facts. And it's a gray line, I know, and we push hard, but we also make sure we stay within the legal boundaries. So I do think it's an obligation we have. If we're asking the community to support a school bond that's going to impact their taxes, that we need to give them enough information that is factual so they know what that would be if they are willing to vote yes, or if they're not, why they're going to vote no. And so we believe we've been very upfront and honest and heavily scrutinized by everybody about what we're saying and what our information is. So I believe if we incorporate, say, $35,000, if we've got a large budget, I mean bond proposition in our budget, and it's publicly reviewed, it goes through all of the many public processes that we do, and there's opportunity for public testimony, that our public is informed that that is part of our budget. The other thing, when I was co-chair with Mark Hamilton in 2002 or 3, I can't remember now, Proposition C, which you've been discussing, I took personal leave as superintendent and did not, any time I worked on that campaign, it had to be outside my work day, and I never was able to identify myself as superintendent, and yes, people knew I was superintendent, but I did not do that. I did not use district equipment, district time. I was on my own personal leave, and I made that clear in any speech I gave. And it was awkward, but it worked. And our attorneys and our board gave me authority to do that. You know, in other words, they reviewed it all and said if I took leave, I was able to be part of that advocacy group that was totally separate from the district. The district did not contribute to the campaign. But, of course, employees, if they were doing something on their own time, they, again, were not allowed to use their title or part of their position to advocate for those particular school bonds, because Anchorage certainly did benefit in the 60-70% debt reimbursement, as well as the Wendler Middle School project. But we were also very committed to advocating for rural Alaska projects and around the state, because everybody benefited, as well as the university. So I would hope that this change will be supported. We're happy to work with you in any way that we could provide information on this piece of legislation.
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Representative Grunberg.
May I go back to Representative Grunberg? A couple of questions.
Well, unless it addresses something that we need for the testimony, I want to get through the testimony.
Thank you. I'll wait.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Hello, Carol. This is Berta Gardner.
Hi.
Do I understand correctly that if this bill passes along with Amendment Y number 1, it would not really change the functioning of Anchorage School District right now?
I'd have to see Amendment Y 1, and I haven't had a second. I just don't have a copy of it, so I don't know what that means. All I've got is Y in front of me, and in reviewing Y and in talking to Ben and Representative Stoltz's office, I believe we would be allowed to continue doing what we've been doing. But I don't know what Y.1 says.
Okay.
And let's get a clarification from Representative Stoltz's staff, if we can.
Ms. Como, this is Ben Mulligan, staff to Rep. Stoltz. What Y.1 does is in why we took that first step in Section 1, but there was additional in the following sections that we needed to follow up and make sure that we, in every section, there was that discrepancy between that you couldn't use school district money to influence a state proposition or question, but you can still, I mean, if you have to do what you need to do on a municipal, what you have been doing on a municipal school bond or the like, that it was going to stay the same. We were not affecting your ability to do that on a local level.
Okay, thanks for the clarification. We don't have Amendment Y1 before us yet, so.
Okay, well, at the way I'm just hearing the discussion, yeah, and what I know about what we've done, we are supportive of this change. And we'll be in Juneau in a week and a half or so, and so we can certainly look at where you are on this one, too.
Thank you, Ms. Cuomo. Is there anyone else that has a question for? Yes, Representative Elkins.
Well, I guess what she's telling us, she would like us to hold this bill till they come to town.
No, that's not what I'm saying, but I just assume that it'll be, I don't know how many committees it's got, but it may not have any. But if it's still not done, we can certainly discuss it further. That's all I'm saying. No, I'm not asking it to be held.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Cuomo.
Thank you very much.
Go to Kathy Wasserman. Oh, you're here. Let me wait just a minute, and we'll go ahead and get some online, and then we'll get to you in just a moment. Thank you. Ron Long, are you online?
Good morning, Chairman Seaton. I am.
Would you identify yourself and who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony?
My name is Ron Long, and I can first tell you who I'm not representing. I'm not representing the Alaska Municipal League, the Kenai Peninsula Borough, or anybody but myself.
Okay.
And I didn't have Amendment Y to look at until it got here to the office, and still don't have Y.1, but I'm encouraged by what I've heard so far. The original version, as you might guess, caused me considerable concern as a local, one of those local officials, you know. And I'm not part of any good faith or bad faith effort to overturn anybody's right to influence anybody about anything, but I do believe that there is a large gap between informing people of the time and place of an election and telling people how to vote. Somewhere within that gap lies some factual information that voters reasonably look to their elected officials, whether they're local or state, to provide things about past budgets, about what possible impacts a tax or a bond might have on their income or earnings or their private business enterprises over the near term, how it might interact with federal or other state agencies. And if we take away that gap and conclude that there's nothing left beyond time and place that's not telling people how to vote, then we leave people looking for their facts that will form the basis of their vote from the coffee shop, from letters to the editor, from the newspapers, whom, of course, we all know wouldn't print it if it wasn't true. I think the existing system is working pretty well. The consequences are pretty straightforward and not usually pleasant for anyone, whether they're state or local, that abuses the system as it exists. It often requires a new job description for that person. It's not possible to me to conclude that everyone in local government or state government is incapable of acting responsibly within the existing law. And this is more fixed than I think is needed for some of the abuses that that may have occurred somewhere around the state. We need to, and I'm accepting on good faith that the Y.1 will address the concerns of some of other local officials like myself who feel that we need to fairly represent some factual evidence to the public so that they can make an informed decision without stepping over the line and telling them how to vote. And we appreciate that compromised position, and we'll be watching with interest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron. That was Ron Long from Seward. Anyone didn't have any questions, but he was representing himself. He clearly stated not any governmental agency. Tom Bodeker?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Oh, great. Thanks, Tom. Would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent for the record?
Yes, this is Tom Bedeker. I am the city manager of Soldotna. If I could proceed, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I have several concerns with the scope of the bill. The question of policy of using public funds for lobbying for the outcome of election is one issue, but my main concerns are when you describe the type of information, as a previous testimony indicated, this goes well beyond advocacy. It limits the type of information that can be distributed to time and place or to some very specific things. In an election pamphlet on state elections that municipalities have no role in developing. Quite simply, when a state ballot proposition comes out, it often affects municipalities, and this bill, as it's structured, would put me in a difficult position. My job is to inform the city council and the citizens of Soldotna, and this bill would put me in the position of saying, I can't give you that information because it could be viewed as information beyond time and place of the election. And this is not saying you're advocating pro or con, but when they say if there's a tax initiative that would limit taxes in the city of Soldotna, my job is to inform the council and the citizens of how that could impact them, and they have to make their own decisions. But this bill would preclude me from giving that information or developing it. And quite frankly, from my standpoint, what they would call me if I told my city council that I couldn't give them that information, they'd call me the former city manager. This is a serious restriction on the ability to provide information to the public for informed voting. I understand the issues the sponsor has with regard to advocacy of outcomes, but this goes well beyond that and I think is much more than is needed to solve the problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. Is there any questions for Tom? Representative Elkin.
Tom, do you think there are a lot of people in your municipality that look to the local government to provide information of this kind to them prior to an election?
Yes, Representative Elkins. I can give examples in some past propositions on almost every one that could affect municipalities. I've been asked to speak at the Chamber of Commerce. I've been asked to go to different groups in the community and explain how this would affect either pro or con the community, just to give facts about it so they can make their decisions. So this occurs on a regular basis in a community like Soldotna, and I think in many other communities.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And now, Brooke Miles, are you online?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Just a moment, Brooke, and would you go ahead and identify yourself and the organization with your who you are with, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brooke Miles. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Offices Commission, and the commission has reviewed House Bill 160 and has not taken a position with respect to this bill. However, I thought it might be useful and that members may have some questions for me regarding how this will be a change from current law. I have, Mr. Chairman, before me the version Y, and am fortunate enough also to have the proposed amendment Y1, and would like to say that the information contained in the amendment would go a far way to clarify and make clear what the sponsor is intending to do here. If I could just very briefly, Mr. Chairman, review how current law works. Under the current campaign disclosure law, municipalities and the state are restricted from using funds to advocate on behalf of a candidate, period, and on behalf of ballot propositions as well, unless those funds are specifically appropriated by municipal ordinance or by state law. As the bill's sponsor testified earlier, in situations, for example, last year, where agencies came before the legislature asking for specific appropriations to advocate on behalf of a potential ballot question, The Finance Committees did not approve that. However, municipalities have, different municipalities have approved, particularly school board advocacy on behalf of school bonds. In addition to requiring that the funds be specifically appropriated if the public entity intends to advocate, that section is actually removed from the law in version Y, as you will see on page 2, beginning at line 4 and going through line 7. However, in the amendment, that provision is restored as I'm reading it. So I believe the commission would support that. Additionally, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to comment because there's been some discussion regarding employees, public employees, taking action in the usual, normal, customary carrying out of their duties. And I wanted to let you know that we do have a regulation on the books currently that is law, or has the effect of law, that provides that in the absence of a specific appropriation, an elected official or an employee of the state or a municipality or one of those one of those entities that is identified in sections A 1 through 4 on page 1 of the bill may use money held by that entity to communicate about a ballot proposition or question if the communication is made in the usual and customary performance of the officers' or employees' duties. Thus, if the city manager of Soldotna routinely attends Chamber of Commerce meetings and other meetings where he provides information and speaks to questions that are on the ballot, that would not be a violation of law. Mr. Chairman, unless you or your committee members have questions for me, that would conclude my testimony today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Brooks. That clarification on the between Y and Y1 or Y.1 was helpful as well. We have two questions for you, one from Representative Gruenberg, and then Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Miles, you have the proposed amendment Y1 in front of you, I see that your testimony likes the fact on page 1, lines basically 9 to 11, that the language has been basically mainly restored. But I'd like you to focus on line 11, where it still prohibits the appropriation by a subsequent state legislature. And I'm wondering if you or the commission have any thought on the constitutionality of whether this legislature can limit the ability of a future legislature to appropriate for a purpose like this.
Well, Representative Gruenberg, that I don't think that's in Ms. Miles' expertise. We'll get that from law, and we can do that. I think it's a good point to raise, but I don't want to ask Ms. Miles to, go outside her expertise.
Okay.
At this time, but we'll hold that question and ask it for law. That's great. Thank you, Representative Lynn, and then Gardner.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier in the testimony today, we heard quite a bit of information about educational materials that are put out by various government entities. And I'm wondering, Ms. Miles, in my campaign, and probably everybody else's campaign, but in my campaign, I sent out quite a few mailers. I thought they were actually political advocacy mailers, but I'm wondering if maybe that was educational material that I sent out. If I sent out, say that Representative Lynn voted yes on specific bills, and no on other specific bills, and those happen to be favorable to my candidacy, when is that political speech by mail, and when is that just educational material? After all, I did cast those votes. I did make those statements on the floor, et cetera. Is that not educational if I send that out? And how that apply to the discussion we've been having here? It seems to me the whole thing can become rather disingenuous.
Brooke, Mr. Chairman?
Can you identify that? Go ahead. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just respond to Representative Lynn, there's a major differences in the rules that regulate how a candidate conducts her or his campaign and how the campaigns for ballot issues are conducted. For example, the law has no restriction on who contributes to a ballot issue or question, including out-of-state, corporations, etc. It further has no restriction on the amount that is contributed. And as you all are very much aware, that is not the situation with respect to candidate campaigns. Now, sometimes an entity, never a candidate's personal campaign, but an entity like a PTA, takes a poll of all candidates and then publishes that poll or a survey in the paper. That would be just informational. But when it's sent by a candidate's campaign, basically everything that's sent by a candidate's campaign is viewed to be in support of that candidate's candidacy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Ms. Miles, you talked about the fact that currently, under current law, elected officials can go ahead about their duties even if it has the effect of advocacy, if it's part of their normal procedure and stuff. In that respect, is there's no change in proposed law from that?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't had a long time to look at this and compare it to the regulation, but I don't believe that making this change in law that would now restrict the state from spending money to influence ballot propositions, either at the state or municipal level, under Y1, or at the municipal level, and everyone restricted at the state level under version Y, would change the area that was carved out by regulation to protect the elected or appointed officials' rights of free speech.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Brooke? Okay. Let's see. Now we have one more online. Anne-Marie Holland, are you there?
Yes. Good morning, Representative Seaton and members of the committee. My name is Anne-Marie Holland. I work in the city manager's office for the city of Homer, and I'm calling today on behalf of the city to express our opposition to House Bill 160. I will admit to being a little confused about the specific version of the bill that's under discussion, but I will express as best I can the city's position on the general concept of prohibiting the use of public funds to get information out regarding a ballot measure. Last October, well, first of all, as you know, municipalities around Alaska have been hit hard by the elimination of state revenue sharing and other state funding. Last October, the Homer City Council put a question on the ballot to increase the local sales tax to address a projected budget shortfall in 2005. That measure failed. Afterward, some members of the public criticized the council and city staff for not doing more to explain why the tax increase was needed. The city council decided to put the question back on the ballot for a special election in March, and this time the city made a concerted effort to get the facts out about increased expenses, reduced revenues, and what it would mean if the sales tax increase did or did not pass. Included in this public education effort was a mailer sent to all registered voters in the two Homer precincts. This time when voters went to the polls, the tax increase passed pretty easily. The city was able to lift a hiring freeze, and we are now in a much better position to serve the needs of a growing community. We were shocked to learn of a bill that would allow municipal funds to be spent only to disseminate information about the time and place of an election. And frankly, our dismay would extend to legislation that narrowed the scope to statewide ballot questions, although that would be less onerous. We still feel like it is not good public policy. Withholding other information other than time and place of an election about proposed legislation does not serve the public interest. Following the elimination of state revenue sharing, House Bill 160 is sort of like adding insult to injury for local governments, and we urge you to vote against this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne Marie, and I would note there are several versions of the bill, and the latest version of the bill we have takes care of some of those concerns. Though I'm not at all willing to say that it takes care of all your concerns, but I would direct you to get from the LIO or from the probably from the LIO the proposed amendments and all, so that you can have those comment on as well. And thank you. Does anyone have a question for Ms. Hole? Thanks again for your testimony. Kathy Wasserman?
Mr. Chairman, can I just add one?
Sure. Yes.
And any one of these local officials or their staff are welcome to call me and Ben, and our intent has been to work with the municipalities, as we've shown through what we've tried to do and through this latest amendment. I hope that's real clear that we're trying to avoid, if they want to promote a local tax increase, they're going to have that opportunity. I don't, as the City of Homer folks just
and Representative Stoltz, before we go on, the amendment Y1 does reinstate the language that a municipality could use money to influence the outcome of municipal election concerning those ballot propositions. And was that your intent? I just want to make sure.
Yeah, just clarifying, it's still a philosophical agreement, but it's my intent to work with the municipalities.
Okay, good. Too many chairs today.
I know. Musical. For the record, my name is Kathy Wasserman. I'm with the Alaska Municipal League. Just to take away any feelings that perhaps we've been deceptive, I'll be very clear. The Municipal League is against House Bill 160. I indeed have made phone calls, as have other members of our staff, but that is our job, to keep municipalities aware of legislation. And sometimes that works to the benefit of sponsors on bills that they may have before the legislature. Information positions on state ballot propositions should be expected by constituents. Information and positions which will hopefully help to explain local and or state impacts. We believe constituents want strong positions on issues by the people they elect. Silence and the appearance of waffling is not good leadership. As a longtime former mayor, I can assure you that local residents closely watch money issues in local communities. They do not need state protection, and checks and balances are available through the voting booth. Decisions on money spent to influence, or I think maybe a better word might be to provide information or even to take a stand on, should be a local decision. If local voters find their local officials have gone too far or over the top, they can then address those matters in the voting booth again. And they can address them through letters to the editor, as we say in Pelican, on the boardwalk, or through, again, the voting booth. We would ask the legislature not preempt local community decisions and their abilities or their freedoms. In response to some of the comments, that was given by the sponsor, the permanent fund board was brought up, and it appears to me that if we can trust the permanent fund board to take care of $30 billion of our money, we can certainly trust them to put out information which helps us be more knowledgeable in how we should invest that money or what should be done with it. I'm also a bit worried about the sources of money when they come to communities, they're dumped into a general fund. How do we separate what came from where and how and where it is spent? And also, I'm very concerned about the gray parameters of this bill. There are some things that could be allowed and some things that could not be allowed, and I think it puts local elected officials in a very dangerous spot to know when they can say something, when they can't, when they can spend money, when they can't. Does it include salary? Does it include copying off something for someone in the community or travel funds? And lastly, I don't think we should demean the local voters by thinking that at the local level we can tell them how to vote. If we could tell them how to vote, there would probably be some things very different. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Ramos and then Representative Elkins.
Well, isn't that precisely what you are doing when you run advertising? You're telling them how to vote. You're offering the city's point of view. I mean, I'm concerned that I see all these elected officials that are all trying to hold on to their right to use the public vehicle, which is a much larger vehicle than the private sector has, as it means, to accomplish something. The news minor, or the newspaper, the editorial page, letters to the editor, why are these not acceptable organs? Television stations, why does there have to be paid for advertising? Why does the government, beyond just providing the election pamphlet information, have to insert themselves into the fray? I mean, obviously, if it's put forward by the municipality, the assembly, the city council, the mayor's whatever organ it is, why do you then have to go allocate money to, prove the point? Well, I must not be getting something.
Representative Ramers, through the chair, I think they have already inserted themselves into the fray as being government and local officials when propositions come up. And I certainly think that the local voters look to those elected officials for information. Call that influence, if you will.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ramers.
But that's precisely my point, is that when my local community decides, okay, we want to do a bonding issue and we want to submit this to the public, my local officials are functioning in that capacity. They're saying, okay, we're going to put up a $30 million school bond. And then I just find it somewhat offensive that they then are able to insert themselves with money and influence into that election. I've seen that in my community. I think we just saw it in Anchorage with the 60-40 vote and then the convention center and museum, and I'm passive to that. That doesn't affect my community, but I've seen it with schools in my community. I happen to vote no on a bond issue for the two elementary schools in my community that passed because I felt that the school board inserted itself into that election cycle, and there was nobody to oppose. There was no private sector money to oppose the school. So in this case, all you had was the public sector out there saying, this school bond issue is good, and there was no advocacy really that said, well, we should think about whether these schools are adequate for another 10 or 20 or 30 years. Can you address that for me?
I think many times certainly I've been aware of many things here in Juneau when they come up. There's letters to the editor all over from other groups. There are many groups around this state who I see as advocates against things that local governments have advocated or that even the state has advocated. I don't think any of those are getting a short shrift on being able to give their input. I think the local governments or a school board that has put out a bond, they're in the fray. They are the ones that have put out the request. I think it's up to them to explain why. And I would hope that their hands would not be tied so that the only people you would hear are the ones against those bonds. There are very few people on the outside of local government who are going to be up there saying, by gosh, give us more taxes.
Precisely.
They're going to want to. There needs to be an explanation. And like the state of Alaska and local municipalities, you're looking for means of money. And sometimes, especially in municipalities, taxes are all that's left.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure it's a question, but.
Well, we'll have committee discussion in just a moment if it's not a question for AML.
Well, it might develop into one, but I'll wait.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. Did you have a question for AML? I want to.
Yeah, but my question is about the same as Representative Ramos, but on the other side, and if I may, isn't it true, Ms. Wasserman, that both sides need to be heard? And the remedy is not to muzzle the free speech, but to allow more free speech. Isn't that the best public policy?
Exactly. I think it takes away a freedom, and much as the committee here usually represents, as well you should, as a local official, You have been elected by those people, so hopefully they hope they made the right choice in your decisions. Many of the dollars that I may put into things in the state go to then the legislature somehow, where decisions come out that I'm not necessarily for, but, you know.
Is it a question or
Yes,
a
it is, sir. Yes. But aren't you then, I'm with you, public officials get elected to have an opinion, but aren't you then asking the public officials to spend the public's money to tell the public what they should think?
Well, again, I think that's a spin, sir. Through the chair to Representative Ramirez, telling infers that they are doing what you say. I don't think that that happens with very many people.
Okay. And Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kathy, over the years that you've been involved, have you found that there are a lot of people out there who are out there fishing or logging or with their head down working and making a living to support their families, and on bond issues and other issues that municipal and state governments come forward, have you found that they look for that short version of that information to help them make an intelligent decision? Because they haven't had a lot of time to listen to the radio or what, and when they're home, they're relaxing, watching a football game or something. But just give me your input on that.
Representative Elkins, through the chair, yes, I do. I served on the convention, the Constitutional 55 convention in Fairbanks last year, and the POMV came up many, many times. And I know, for instance, I had many of my constituents in Pelican want an explanation of the POMV. Had it come to a vote, you know, that would have been very difficult to do.
Representative Elkins, one follow-up.
Thank you. I was against the POMV until the state came to Ketchikan and presented it to the Chamber of Commerce. And I now believe they were right. Thank you.
Okay, and we're going to, we don't have anyone else here or no one online. We're going to close public testimony in this bill, and we will hold 160 for committee discussion. Yes, Representative.
I had a couple of questions that will lead to possibly them getting some more information. May I ask?
Yes, Representative Stoltz, can you come up for just a very brief moment here?
Representative Stoltz, through the chair. I had asked for some legal opinions before, and since then, I've thought of a few other things, and I was wondering if either you have answers or you can get answers for us. A constitutional question on the constitutional ability and the constitutionality of this bill and this legislature to limit the ability of future legislatures to appropriate money. That's my first. And secondly, a practical question. As Ms. Wasserman said, the money that comes from the state, if there is any money that indeed that comes from the state anymore, goes into a general local treasury. How are the local government supposed to separate out this money so that they know whether this dollar that goes into the treasury is used for this purpose? It seems to me it's impossible as a practical matter to separate it out. How would this work?
Well, Chairman Seaton, the last time. I have a presumption that it's in the treasury, it's a public fund, but I'll look for clarification on that. And I'll get clarification on the first question. I don't really think it's an issue. We already have a statute that prohibits use of any state funds to advocate for candidates. We don't. We're not binding this legislature. I guess we could pass a law to repeal that. I mean, we're certainly not bound. But we would have to change the statute. I think you're reaching a little bit. But I will clarify that.
Thank you. And appreciate that. And so we're going to put 160 aside, and we'll now take 238. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time, and I appreciate the questions and the guidance.
Thank you, Rick.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would just ask, do you want us
So we can get a CS and have this melded in. Do you want us to do this so we see how this melds in? I'm prepared to offer that amendment.
Reverend Stoltz, well, are you accepting of Y1 as
yeah, Mr. Chairman, in good faith, and that's it was my intent to work with the local municipalities to clarify that, and that would probably take away a lot of the questions that are out in the public.
Very, very good. Representative Grunberg, would you make a motion for...
I would move that we adopt, for the purposes of discussion and the preparation of a new CS, Y1, so we can have that and have it distributed.
Very good. Do we have any objection to adoption of Amendment Y.1? Okay, we will do that and have a new CS for us at our next time we consider the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Now we have House Bill 238, and you have hopefully people brought their packets from the last time where we had a number of runs of HRA. That was one thing that we wanted to go over, and now you are being handed out a new draft of all the with tracking changes, and we found a color printer so that you can see these are the changes that we talked about last time during the committee hearing, and they're just been incorporated into the language. And there's also one retyped paragraph here. So I think what we're going to do is take a 3 minute at ease and give everybody a chance to read. Look through those and see if there's any problems.
Are we still using the...